The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. David Haidu, who hails from New Jersey, is the kind of guy who once refused to buy a car because the radio didn't dial in WMMR. Now the music critic for the New Republic and a professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, he admits that he might not make that same choice today. His career began in 1977 when he started writing for The Village Voice and Rolling Stone and later served as top editor at Entertainment Weekly. Since then, he has written for The American Scholar, The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, and Vanity Fair, among others. He is the author of Lush Life, a biography of Billy Strayhorn, which you may have recognized some of the music that we were playing earlier, some Strayhorn, and Positively Fourth Street, the lives and times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez Farinha, and Richard Farinha, which he presented at the library in 2001, before I was born. Both books were finalists for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and both won the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award. His latest work, The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America, uses biography, the historical record, and joyous prose to tell the tale of the comic book's formidable impact on popular culture. Please welcome David Haidu.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Sandy, for that beautiful introduction that my mother wrote, and thanks to my mother for writing. And thanks for coming out and being here. I'm very excited. I'm going to move this microphone. Not that I need to, but it's obligatory. You just have to do this. I'm very happy to be here. I've been here before. I love the series, and I love what Andy does, and it's a matter of great pride for me to be here. Also, especially happy to be in a library because the library has a special place in my heart. I talked a little bit about this the last time I was here, which is some years ago now. Did anybody come to that last reading, that last talk? Okay, one. Andy was here. Okay, well, good, because I told a little story then that I only ever told here. I'll tell it again because it has to do with the importance of the library to me. And if you had been here then, you would think that everywhere I go, I tell this story. I don't. It's only the second time I've told it. I grew up in a valley north of the Delaware Valley in the Lehigh Valley. You must all know the Lehigh Valley, a little outside of Easton, in a town on the Jersey side called Phillipsburg, which is a smoky little factory town in New Jersey. I was a child of first-generation immigrants, Hungarian and Italian. And my mother's generation grew up in an area of town that was built for the men who lent their bodies to the production of steel in the mills down in this area of town that was called the Flats. It was the flat part of town by the river where the trains carried in and out the goods that were manufactured in the steel mill. And the first generation of immigrants worked and lived in the flats. And the second generation, their offspring, which is... my grandmother lived in the flats. And then the next generation, my parents, my mother and father, moved to the hill. And the hill represented social ascension. Now, there were actually two hills in Phillipsburg. Is D. Gager here? No? Okay. There's an attorney in Philadelphia by the name of D. Gager. I went to high school with her. There were actually two hills. If you lived on my hill, we called it the hill, and if you lived on the other hill, it was the other hill. But if you lived on the other hill, that was the hill, and our hill was the other hill. It's just kind of a meaningless detail. But the hill represented social ascension, and those of us who grew up there were forbidden from returning to the flats because the flats The second generation got white collar jobs, and the flats were where the blue collar jobs were, and it seemed vaguely urban and dark and dangerous. And it returned to kind of, you know, squalor. And my brother and my sister and I were forbidden to go to the flats. The gangs were there. You know, there were African Americans there as well as Italians. So we were allowed only to go to the library, which was the only place in the flats we were allowed to go was the library. And the library, the only place my parents would permit us to go in this area was the library, because the library, we all knew, was a conduit out of this world. The library was a place where, through books and through literature, through enlightenment, we could find ennoblement, and it was our window out. And we were allowed to go to the library. In fact, my brother and my cousin would skip school to go to the library. It was a sacred place to us. And the library still is a sacred place to me. I'd spend most of my time there. I live kind of a monastic life, you know, sequestered in the library doing my books and also do interviews. But the library is a sacred place to me. I want to talk about this new book I wrote called The 10-Cent Plague. And it's not a memoir, but it is an inquiry into some of the issues that I just mentioned in this little library story. It is an inquiry into the issues of class and enlightenment and even ennoblement and coming of age and of maturation. It's a story of a coming of age of a generation. It's the story of a coming age of an indigenous American art form, the comic book. I want to tell you about that, and I'm going to read a little bit from you, show a video clip, and hope we have some fun. The book is called The 10-Cent Plague, and it's a narrative history of, one, the emergence of a certain sphere of comic books, not superhero comics, but a wholly different sort of comics, the lurid, racy, frightful, violent kind of comics, which supplanted superhero comics in popularity during the early post-war years. And it's also a narrative history, too, of the effect of that work on the lives of its readers, of its creators, and of the culture at large. So, in part, the book is a story of a group of creative artists, and it tells how they came to make the art they made. So it's a history of a school of work, in a way. And it's also a war story, but in the sense broader than that of the traditional military history. It's a story of a battle between two generations, battle between parents and their kids and two institutions, the government and the conservative establishment of the late 1940s and the early 1950s, and the comic book industry and its people involved in the making of comics and the reading of comics. It's a battle between the protectors of the prevailing conceptions of social propriety, moral values, and traditional aesthetic values on one hand, and on the other hand, a breed of cultural and aesthetic insurgents who were breaking rules in a freewheeling new form of vernacular expression. So it's a war story. And the plague that the title refers to, there are two plagues in the book. The title has two meanings. On one hand, it refers to the plague that comics were thought to be in the late 1940s and early 50s, an insidious viral contagion that was corrupting the minds and the spirits of young people, like a plague, on one hand. And two, ultimately, when the conservative authorities cracked down on comics and enacted the near death of the comic book field, the effect on comic book creators was like a plague, too. So it has two meanings. Now, it's not well known today. I don't know how many people here would remember or know this, that in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, the comic book was the single most popular form of entertainment in America. It's hard for us to fathom that today because we think of comics as being something for, although the comic book movies are huge, we think of comic books themselves as appealing to an object of fandom. It appeals to a subculture of aficionados and fans. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, between 80 million and 100 million copies of comic books were purchased every week. Now, those are staggering numbers, 80 million to 100 million every week. And a typical issue was passed around and traded at least 6 to 10 times. Now, if you do the math, those comics are reaching an awful lot of people. Kids weren't buying them and keeping them in their slip cases and keeping them in vaults as sacred objects. They were reading them and trading them, and they were reaching hundreds of millions of people every week. Comics were reaching more people than television, movies, radio, or magazines for adults. By 1952, more than 20 publishers were producing nearly 650 comics titles per month, and they employed well over 1,000 artists, writers, editors, letterers, and others. Among them were a great many members of racial, ethnic, and social minority groups who turned to comics because they felt that in comics they could express their status as outsiders in a world where they were welcome and in a world that was not foreclosed to them as they thought conventional media of expression were indeed foreclosed to them, mainstream magazines, movies, book publishing. So comics were created by outsiders of various sorts, and they gave voice to their makers' fantasies and discontent in the vernacular of cartoon drawings and word balloons. And as a result, they spoke with special cogency, special urgency to young people who felt like outsiders in a world that was geared for, made by, catering to adults. And in the 40s, we have to remember, the idea of youth culture as it would later be known, as we think of youth culture today as a vast socioeconomic system comprising modes of behavior and styles of dress and of music and of literature that were intended primarily to express independence from the status quo, this was all not yet fully formed. Childhood and young adulthood were still considered phases of sub-adulthood, phases of training to enter the orthodoxy. So comics were radical in their time, among books of their day, for being written, drawn, priced, and marketed primarily for and directly to kids, as well as for asserting a sensibility that was anathema to grown-ups. So comics in those days, like sodas and candy bars, were among the few things that children of the time could afford to buy by saving the pennies they could pick up on the sidewalk or earn by running errands. And they instilled a pride in ownership that was rooted not in adult conceptions of value, but in their absence. But in the absence of adult conceptions of value. So parents considered comics worthless. And that's where they got their value to kids. Because parents thought they were worthless, they were valuable to kids. So comics were capital in the social economy of young adulthood, but void among adults. Nearly all people then, boys, girls, loners, athletes, scholars, debutantes, everybody read comics, and most of their parents did not. So to read comics was to belong to a, at once vast and also exclusive club whose membership was restricted primarily by age. Now, most adults never paid much attention to comics until the comics and the kids that read them started to change. I want to read one brief passage from my book before we get into how those comics changed and what the consequences were. And this would give you a little sense of what the freewheeling atmosphere of comic books in the early days of the medium. This is just three paragraphs from the second chapter that evokes a bit of the atmosphere of early comics. Okay? I'm not going to read much. I'm not going to read anything other than this because I want you to buy the book. So it says, starts out, Harry A. Chesler. Harry A. Chesler put quotation marks around the A in his name. Harry A. Chesler, Jr., the comic book packager, he packaged comic books, applied the Jr. to his name, or dispensed with it as he saw fit, and put quotation marks around the initial because they thought they were stylistically correct. He thought that that was what you should do. And he had a point. When he was asked what the A stood for, he said anything. Indiscrimination was his middle name. Stubby and gray-skinned, he dressed in striped shirts and suit vests that often but not always matched his pants. He kept a derby laid flat atop his head all day, indoors, and he was usually smoking a cigar, proportionately stubby and also gray, with the label intact. A fancy label that could impress anyone who did not know much about cigars. Chesler, a stickler for efficiency, minimized the creative effort required of his artists to render him in caricature. He set up his studio in a long open workspace, last used by a wholesaler of buttons and zippers for the garment trade, on the fourth floor of a 10-story, half-block-long building north of 29th Street in Manhattan. Chesler filled the room with rows of used desks, which were cheaper than drawing tables, and he lorded over the shop as if it were a gangland fiefdom. Anyone arriving for work 5 minutes late would be docked an hour's wages. And on payday, he would sit behind the desk in his office, summon the artists one by one, and ask each of them, "How much do you need this week to get by?" Late in 1939, Irwin Hasson, anybody know that name? He later did Dondi. Late in 1939, Irwin Hasson joined Chesler's staff. Hasson was just beginning to work professionally in art, and at 21 was still living with his parents, who had a furniture business go bankrupt and were rock-skipping from apartment to apartment in Manhattan to avoid going under. Hasson was an all-around artsy fellow who could have passed for Mickey Rooney's more effervescent, smaller brother. He had taken some drawing classes at the National Academy of Design and Art and the Art Students League, but abandoned his first aspiration, fine art, as impractical. He had a good compositional sense and applied himself to his assignments for Chesler, among the first of which was a detective story about a counterfeiting ring published by a comic line called Timely, which we now know as Marvel. Okay. Not long after Hasson stacked the pages and submitted them to his boss, Chesler walked over to his drawing table and told him, "Good work, kid. That's a hell of a job you did. I'm going to play that up big." At the end of the day, as Hasson cleared up his materials, he realized that he had inadvertently given Chesler only the top page of the story he had done. All the sheets of the drawing board underneath it were blank. I interviewed Hasson, and he said, "That's when I learned something about the comic book business at that point in time. It was going gangbusters no matter what you did, and nobody was really paying any attention. Nobody cared what the heck was actually on the pages. It's true. They could be blank, and nobody would notice. I wouldn't be surprised if Chesler sent those pages to the printer." End of quote. Now, while nobody was looking, the comic artists created this kind of wild, freewheeling American art form. They were, nobody really was watching for a while. Unlike the movies and the broadcast media, comic books had no effective monitoring or regulatory mechanism. They had no powerful censoring body like the film industry's Hays Office. No government authority like the FCC imposing content restrictions. Uninhibited, shameless, frequently garish and crude. sometimes shocking, sometimes excessive. The comics that emerged in the late 1940s and 50s are crime, that were focused on crime and horror and romance provided young people of the early post-war years with the means of defying and escaping the mainstream culture of the time, while providing the guardians of that culture with an enormous taunting target. During the early post-war years, comics shifted in tone and content. As I mentioned earlier, many of the titles that were most prominent in this period told lurid stories of crime and vice, lust, and horror, rather than the noble stories of costumed heroes and heroines like Superman we think of when we think of comics, or Captain Marvel and Wonder Woman, whose adventures had initially established the comics. I want to tell you a little bit about the content of some of the comics that I'm talking about, these lurid comics focused on crime and romance and horror and vice. The publisher of the most serious, most venturesome, and most provocative titles was EC Comics. That company was owned by Bill Gaines, who later became better known for publishing Mad Magazine, which I grew up on and many of you probably grew up on. My kids are growing up on now. EC published crime, horror, suspense, science fiction, and romance titles, as well as titles that mixed up all those genres in strange combinations. For instance, I did a title called Saddle Justice. It was a Western crime comic. And then that later morphed into Saddle Romances. It was kind of a Western crime romance comic. One of the dominant themes of EC Comics was a cynicism toward marriage and domesticity. The pages of nearly all the EC Comics, including the science fiction titles, were swelling with portrayals of marriage and family life as sources of unbearable torment. Married people were almost always miserable, desperate, conniving, and/or murderous. Bill Gaines said, looking back on those days, quote, "We got a lot of mileage out of scheming wives and vengeful husbands." In the horror comics that EC was most famous for, the true graveyard was the living room of the American home. One of their artists, Jack Kamen, said, this is a quote from an interview with Jack Kamen, he said, "There were no happy couples, except maybe the girl and the truck driver in the end, and something terrible would happen to them, too. There was no such thing as a happy household in EC," end of quote. Really, to understand the importance of this, to remember that to young people of the post-war years, when the mainstream culture glorified and romanticized suburban domesticity as the modern American ideal, nothing in the panels of EC Comics, I mean, not the monsters or the aliens and the cockroaches that ate people and the ray guns, nothing was as subversive as the idea that the exits of the Long Island Expressway entered onto levels of hell. So Gaines and his partner, Al Feldstein, filled the pages of EC Comics with coded challenges to the prevailing standards of normalcy. They worked allegorically, as a rule, through genre stories. And in these stories, they sought to engender sympathy for misfits, underdogs, and exiles of every breed. Human, animal, fish, alien, living, dead, undead, and combinations thereof. Now, I mentioned romance comics a few minutes ago, and because the genre has been dead for so long, and because whatever we think of it is probably more informed by Lichtenstein canvases than by real knowledge of romance, I want to tell you a little bit about the romance comics, because they were not what we are. Most of us are likely to think that they were. I got lost like Reagan in the syntactical morass a second ago. But romance comics are not what we probably think they were. There we go. Contrary to the images in our received memory, a great many romance comics actually defied romantic formula and cliché. They portrayed young women struggling to break free of the social conventions of the day. A great many of the romance comics of the 40s and early 50s told stories of free-spirited, willful young women, free, willful young women, proto-feminist women, who thought and acted independently, challenging not only their parents, but their boyfriends. Adults and males. So significant challenges in those days. And no other genre of comics was as overt, as outright in its depiction of youthful rebellion as romance comics, in which stories like I Joined a Teenage Sex Club, that's the title of a comic, or My Mother Was My Rival, were not uncommon. And the fact that romance comics were at first seen as harmless, you know, just love stories, you know, just for girls, girl stuff, allowed them to flourish in an area, in an era when other comics were beginning to be held in suspicion and their impact was all the greater. I'll tell you about one story, for example, a story called I Set a Trap for a Wolf. It was published in 1948. It follows a woman in a scheme to outdo a male teenage Lothario. There's no female Lothario, right? So that's redundant. It's teenage Lothario. She, first of all, she dares to call him on a date, which is a scandalously aggressive act in 1948. Then she persuades him to crash a party with her. She leads him on a midnight walk. She makes all the sexual advances. She tells her sister in the comic, "We girls should demand equal rights with boys. Isn't this a free country? Why shouldn't we be allowed to do everything boys do?" Can you imagine the impact that this had in 1948? Now, what happened in the late 1940s and the early 1950s was eventually the prevailing, the conservative culture at the time got wind of what was going on in those pages. And America went absolutely hysterical over comics and what they represented. Churches and community groups organized campaigns against comics. Teachers had students act out mock trials of comics characters. Schools held public burnings of comics by the dozens. They weren't just one or two isolated events. There were dozens of them all around the country. Children conducting vast oblational bonfires, burning of books just a few years after World War II. When that was going on somewhere else. Headlines in newspapers and magazines around the country warn readers with headlines like this: "Depravity for Children at 10 cents a copy, Horror in the Nursery, The Curse of the Comic Books." Finally, the offices of EC Comics were raided by the New York City police. More than 100 acts of legislation, including a bill introduced in Pennsylvania, were introduced on the state and municipal level. I've got to repeat that. 100 acts of legislation introduced in the state and the municipal level to ban or limit the sale of comics. Crime comics were banned outright in the state of New York. They were illegal in the state of New York. Scores of titles were outlawed in New York, Connecticut, Maryland, and other states, and ordinances to regulate comics were passed in dozens of cities. Soon after this, Congress took action with a set of sensationalized televised hearings that ended up nearly destroying the comic book business. I want to show you a little video clip that gives you a sense of how hysterical the country was. How are we doing on time? Over comics. So, Paul, if you could get that video clip ready. This is a clip from an early television news magazine program from the 1952-53 called Confidential Style. And it was a precursor to 60 Minutes, but it specialized in sensationalistic topics, racy topics like child prostitution, gangs, drug use, and comic books. I'm going to show you a bit of the half-hour-long episode that was devoted to comic books, Confidential File. Can we see it? Is it ready? Here we go. The host is Paul Coates, a former newspaper columnist from Los Angeles, but it was a national program. Okay, Confidential File.
Thank you.
He's not suggesting that. Okay, Paul, you can stop there. Okay, let's have the lights. So, I mean, it's easy for us to laugh now. It looks comical now, but that was a really quite terrifying to parents in those days, because it reinforced something that parents saw all around them, that young people were different. Generation was growing up with a different set of tastes and a different set of values than their parents, and they seemed to be running wild, and comic books were the scapegoat. And there'll be a sense of this, and you'll see how the purge against comics was very much a parallel to McCarthyism, owing to the legislation that was passed in the mid-1950s and the overall crackdown in the comic book industry. More than 800 people who had worked in comics were never, ever worked again in the field. I end the book with an appendix that's essentially a war memorial of the people who had been working in comics, writing, drawing, and editing, who were never again published in the comic book pages. And it's 800 names like this. And it could go on and on and on and on and on. I interviewed many of them for the book, and 50 years later, they were still wounded by the set of events. This book is a story of the battle over comics and the effect on the comic book creators and the effect on the generation of people who grew up with comics, who were ultimately the victors because they embraced the sensibility and the aesthetic of comics and turned it into what we now think of as post-war popular culture. So that's the story and the thesis of the book. And I'm happy to take questions. Now, in the questions, you should feel free to ask anything, not only about this book, but if you do have any questions about my first two books, I'm happy to take them as well. That's Lost Life, the biography of Billy Strayhorn, Positively 4th Street, a group portrait of four folk artists of the 1960s. And naturally, we'll talk most about this. But I'm happy to take any questions you have. And I will ask you to wait until the mic comes to you. So this gentleman right here in the third row, and just wait until you get the mic. And the floor is yours.
Thank you. I have two questions, one facetious and one serious. The facetious one is, did Dick Cheney grow up on comic books? The serious one, Rosie the Riveter had just previously been banished from the workplace. Did that have some bearing on the comic books that were addressed to women during the late 40s?
I don't. The question. Well, you all heard the question. What's the bearing of the return of women to the home? Women had been, many women whose realm of functioning had been the domestic. Now, by the way, I know from growing up in a maternal Italian household that there's no understating what is involved, and how much, intelligence and command goes into running a household like my mother's. Believe me, if she could, my mother could have run an international conglomerate, and instead she did put all that effort into this house. But that said, it's a bit of a digression. Women on the whole, as we all know, during the early 1950s, women of the war generation, the World War II generation, returned to the home. Comic books spoke to their daughters and their sons, and it challenged the notion that the home and the domestic realm was an ideal. So I don't think there's a direct connection. But there's a relationship, and that's about the best answer I could give to that. Back there, there's another question. Way back in the third row from the back.
It sounded like you was expressing some censorship of the comic books, and it seemed that it was in the era of Cagney, John Garfield, and Humphrey Bogart, which was what adults looked at and showed some of the same type of activities.
I'm sorry. You said after censorship. Could you a little bit louder?
Bogart and John Garfield and them, they did, you know, things like that for adults, right. And that wasn't censored. I want, you know.
Right. John Garfield, the HUAC hearings and the censorship of the Hollywood, the crackdown on the Hollywood 10 in Hollywood during the era of the Red Scare. They're absolute utter parallels. And what they have in common is a paranoia, opulent paranoia. But where they diverge is where the comics purge and the comic scare diverges from the Red Scare, is that the Red Scare was a fear of a threat from outside our borders and from outside our culture. It was a fear of another culture, a foreign culture, the Soviet Union and communism of infiltrating ours and corrupting our America and taking over. The significant difference is that the comic book scare and was a fear of a threat not from without, but from within. From within this culture, from a threat of our own kind, our children turning against us. And that's a very deep-rooted fear. As a father of three myself, and as many of you parents you know how deep that fear runs. That fear of your children somehow turning against you and becoming something other than you will, you know, want them so dearly to become. That's why the comic book purge cuts so deep with the generation of parents who grew up in the era of World War II. Another question over here. This gentleman near the front. I think you were next. I can't see that well. Gentleman here.
Do you think there are parallels between the comic book scare and the current video game scare with violent video games?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Are there parallels? Oh, good question. Are there parallels between the fear of video games and comic books? Yes, and yeah, the obvious parallel is that a new homegrown form of entertainment that speaks to one generation and is not well understood by the older generation is absorbed with violence and treats violence as play. That's the obvious parallels. And there's a kind of extremism in both cases. Now, it's hard for us to imagine what was on those pages of comics. Looking at them from the lens of the present, it's hard for us to imagine how extreme they were at the time. But believe me, they were. And Paul Coates and reading a script by a writer named A.J. Fennedy was not exaggerating that much in some of what he said when he talked about the subject matter of some of these comics. Necrophilia, yes, true. Sadomasochism, yes, true. And prurience and a reveling in violence that really isn't, it's really complicated. On one level, kids understood that they were just stories and kids could decode them. And on one level, they were a release valve for kids. And one level, kids took to these comics as a way to confront evil, confront good and bad, wrestle with these issues. Evil is present in the world. Evil is present in the Bible. It reminds us of the imperative of good. So there's a value to the confronting evil in these comics. But like video games today, those comics did go too far. I can sympathize with people who saw those comics as being extreme and going too far. You know, I'm not comfortable with Grand Theft Auto, and I don't want my 4.5-year-old playing it, or Hostel 2, the Hostel movies with the extraordinary excessive violence in those films. So there are parallels, and the questions remain, and the answers aren't easy ones any more today than they were then. Anything else? Yes, back here.
First, I want the opportunity to thank you for Positively 4th Street, which is just a fabulous multidimensional book.
Oh, thank you very much. But
my question today
is... This is better.
Okay. My question is, what do you think about graphic novels? Does that fit in with any of your theses?
Yeah, that's a good question. I deal with the quality of the work, and the work not only as a social phenomenon, but as an art form in this book. And I deal with the aesthetics of the art form in this book, because I think that comics are worthwhile at their best. And there was some fine work being done that was all mixed up with questionable work. But the book is, in part, a story of the coming of age of an American art form. And I think that the people who created comics and the people who read comics it's hard to think of them as mattering much unless what they made matters. You know, unless the work is good, it's hard to have much sympathy for the people who made it and for the people who read it. And I think that much of the work is good. And the first... much of the work is dubious, but much of the work really is good, and it's worth our coming to terms with and our appreciating as an important American art form. The first graphic novels were not created in the 1970s, but in the 1950s. And I have a sizable section on the first graphic novel, which was a book called It Rhymes with Lust. That was drawn by a largely forgotten African American artist named Matt Baker. So the artist of the first graphic novel was Matt Baker. It came out of Pittsburgh, a Pennsylvania native who's just absolute brilliant. Did the first graphic novel 60 plus years ago. And the work of Matt Baker and EC inspired the generation of artists in the 1970s who made the graphic novels that we think of as the first graphic novels today. And they, Art Spiegelman and Daniel Clowes and Joe Sacco and that current generation of graphic novels treasure this work and revere it and hold it very close to their hearts. Anything else? Yes, up here?
Two things. First, it seems to me the timing is similar to that of rock and roll, and that was also very scary to parents. And secondly, with regard to the scariness of new things, the form of comics is not just Nancy and Sluggo and Lulu and some of the other little comics that I used to read, but the coming of, well, the banning and getting rid of books by libraries that communities find offensive, like Huckleberry Finn, the use of the cable networks that now allow children to watch all kinds of things, where parents need to ban stations so their children can't be damaged by certain programs. The internet, where all kinds of information can be gotten, plus the various games. As each new form of communication comes, it makes it easier for people of all ages to be exposed to all kinds of things. And the danger isn't in the exposure, but in the limiting of the exposure. But it seems that each generation finds something which is just too dangerous for the next generation to see.
I think each generation embraces something, this work, precisely because it's perceived as dangerous to the previous generation. They embrace it as a challenge to the status quo and as a challenge to the previous generation. I should point out a significant fact that this set of events took place prior to rock and roll. And if one way that my book is... if it's radical in any way, it's in repositioning what we now think of as the birth of the post-war sensibility in a set of events that took place several years before the rise of rock and roll. So a lot of what we think of that started with rock and roll really started several years before in this other sphere in comic books. I think we have time for, I guess, one more question. Right, Andy? One more question. Yeah, sir, right here.
Thank you. Was EC a particular target during this time?
One more time?
Was EC Comics a particular target during this time?
Particular target. Yeah, EC Comics was the main target at this time. And at the Senate hearings that took place that really enacted the near death of the comic book industry, the key witness on the behalf of the comic book industry was Bill Gaines. And he testified on a Dexedin bender. And it was a tragic event. It's kind of the climax of the book, the hearings and Bill Gaines' testimony. But it was the front page of the New York Times the next day, lead story in Time Magazine in the next issue, comic book hearings and Bill Gaines' horrible testimony. Well, I hate to end with such a downer. But I guess I'll have to. Thanks very much for coming. I'm very grateful.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.